Hello and welcome to Live at the Backyard Comedy Club podcast, everybody. It's me again, Chris, on my own. David couldn't be here, but he will be here for the rest of the podcast, where we'll be talking to the amazing Matt Green. But in the meantime, I have been programming my own version of David for these intros. So he's here right now to announce the opening of the podcast. Go, robot David!
Release the terabytes!
Oh, I made it far too creepy. Kind of like David, actually. Enjoy the podcast.
A lot of, I believe, young people's main source of music is YouTube.
Spotify.
YouTube and Spotify. YouTube more so, actually. Yeah,
yeah, but I believe YouTube is the...
Is the number one spot.
Is the go for... Oh, come on, Chris, you're a millennial. You're meant to be our source for this.
I can't be bothered to go on YouTube. Who's got time to watch things these days? It's all about what can be injected straight into your ear. Your ear.
Your ear.
That's what millennials are about. Hello, Matt.
Hello.
Hello, mate. We've started.
Have we?
Yeah, we started with, you know, decoding.
Right, okay.
We ended.
Music.
Yeah. Okay, cool.
We just like to ease in gently.
Fair enough.
Rather than anything abrupt.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome to the podcast. Thanks for doing this. You're
no
performing here this evening.
And tomorrow.
And it's Friday and Saturday night shows.
Mm-hmm.
Fun in the East End of London.
You're
suited and booted, like a comic that's suited and booted.
Yeah, I've been sort of suited and booted for about 3 or 4 years now. I think I've been wearing suits, and I just think I kind of got to a point where I was in my sort of early 30s and thinking I wanted to somehow distinguish myself from the massive number of acts who were sort of early 20s and sort of wearing jeans and t-shirts, and I realised I was still wearing jeans and t-shirts, and I thought that was just one way of going. I'm a little bit old on that. I'm not, you know.
Right.
That
yeah.
kind of thing. And also, you know, in a sort of mercantile way, I realised that I was doing a few corporate gigs over, you know, every so often. And you have to wear a suit and sometimes even like a black tie or whatever for that. And I was always a bit uncomfortable.
Black tie?
I haven't performed
in a black tie.
Yeah, I've done a few. Mostly hosting an award ceremony or something, you know, where they're all in black ties. So if you're
what
not,
sort of award ceremonies have you done?
I've done a couple. There's one I do quite a lot called the Top Employers Awards, which is great.
Quite a lot, and presumably no more than once a year.
No, once a year, but once a year a few times, which is always fun. It's nice when they get you back.
Yeah.
But yeah, I've done one or two over the years. And I mean, I'm by no means doing loads of corporates, but I realised that when I was doing them in a suit, I was sort of a bit like, oh, I'm sort of in my work clothes, which I wasn't used to. And so I thought actually a good way of getting used to it is just wear it all the time.
All the time. I think that's a good attitude to comedy in general. Like, I remember doing sort of like really important competitions and suddenly not having a drink and feeling nervous as fuck. And
yeah.
Well, whatever your shed, whatever you, if you do have a pint, I'm not advocating getting smashed before going on.
Yeah.
But if you habitually have a pint before, when you arrive at a comedy club, then you should probably have it when it's an important gig too. You shouldn't.
Yeah, don't change your routine. It's. I think. Yeah, I've not done a gig on telly, like a sort of televised gig. But I imagine those are a similar thing that you've got to try and make them feel like just a normal gig as far as you can. You know, obviously there'll be different things about it. But
sure.
You know, every time you do a gig where you're a bit nervous, I think try to get the routine the same as you normally do is a big help. I think. Yeah, definitely.
Obviously, you know, half the time we're on the road, so, you know, one can't indulge too much, but so you do have to change it. But changing your routine can make you just feel not funny.
Yeah, although on the other hand, just to be devil's advocate for myself for a second, I think the other thing you've got to be careful about is superstitions.
Yeah.
Because, there are so many comics. It's like sport or anything where people go, oh, I've got to be wearing those specific shoes, or I've got to have that t-shirt on, or I've got to have a drink every gig.
Yeah.
And then, if you're in a venue which doesn't serve alcohol, or you're driving or whatever, and you suddenly go, I can't do that. Yeah. I realised quite early on that it's quite easy to get into those habits.
Sure,
And that's slightly different. That's not a routine. That's dangerous if you kind of just go, right, I have to be wearing a specific thing, or I have to be doing a certain thing.
It's... There is a sort of like what makes you feel different, and but you can put yourself emotionally into that place rather than it being. I remember turning up to a gig, having come from the gym, and thinking I had a pair of shoes.
Right.
I had changed out of my gym kit, but I hadn't got a pair of actual smart shoes.
Yeah.
In my bag. And I had my trainers on. I go, I'll never go on stage in trainers. I'll just feel so weird. And then had an absolutely wonderful gig and decided that I'd always gig in trainers.
Right, yeah.
And then until the bad gig happened, exactly, and then it was the trainer's fault. And obviously, neither of those things were ever I was like, I keep telling myself all sorts of nonsense. Oh yeah, I was more sort of like light on my feet. I was moving around a lot. I was more animated. I was less rooted.
Yeah,
like, you know, you're fucking telling jokes. Not playing five a side.
Yeah, exactly. And some of the most animated performers ever, like Lee Evans, whatever, wears suit and tie, and you know, and he's quite. But you know, that's just, he just does that and he goes with it. And I think I think for me, Edinburgh was always the real, and still remains, the kind of the difficult thing for that is that, because it's so different, the venues you play in Edinburgh are often very hot, basically.
Bizarrely,
quite small and just ridiculously hot, considering there's no air conditioning in most of them. Right. These days they have got a little bit better at that, but certainly when I was doing my early shows there, just no air conditioning, so you'd just be sweat. And I'm someone who's naturally quite sweaty and quite, if I move around at all, I get quite hot. And so for years, I spent years trying to work out how to wear the right clothes for, you know, what should I wear, like dry fit stuff, you know, kind of gym stuff that kind of, you know, wicks sweat away, or should I wear, so one year I wore like dry fit top and sort of special, you know, dry fit trousers that were designed for gym work and stuff. And I realized after a while, I was like, actually, you just have to wear what you look good in, and then get yourself comfortable with that. And even if it was the first year I wore a suit, and it was really hot. It was too hot.
Did you wear a suit for the whole month?
I did, but I did. And the first year I did it, I took my jacket off quite early on in the show because I was like, this is too hot. And then the second year, I was like, no, fuck it, I'm just going to keep it on. Right. And then if I look really sweaty, it's fine. Like, no one cares in the end. No. You know, you have to just get through that yourself and kind of. But it took me a long time to get to that point. And it is irritating, like, if you're really, really sweaty.
Yeah.
But the sort of. In a way, I realised, actually, if you're wearing a suit and you're really sweaty, people go, no, it's because he's wearing a suit. If you're wearing a T-shirt, they're like, why is he so sweaty? Yeah. So in a way, it's kind of better to have something, almost go on wearing a coat. And they're kind of, they've got no reason to.
Yeah.
Well, you mentioned Lee Evans. He is the first person I ever saw actually manage to sweat through a suit.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I've never seen anything like that. I thought, that's a sweaty man.
I've done that in an Edinburgh show a couple of times where it's been really hot and you go, afterwards you're like, oh, lovely. It's like actually wet. But I don't move around as much as he does.
Did you have numerous suits throughout the month? And I just keep getting
I always just buy two.
Yeah.
You know, and just alternate them. Mm. And I'm wearing blue suits at the moment. I've worn grey ones. You know, I just sort of, every year or so, I sort of buy a new pair of suits and wear them out.
Just get linen suits next time, like the band from Del Monte.
I am wearing a linen suit at the moment, but it's a sort of linen cotton blend, which is quite nice. But I just buy them fairly, you know, reasonably sort of cheap places and just wear them out until.
Yeah. Would you like to give your tailor a plug? Where do you?
It's Mr. River Island.
Ah,
who I've learned I fit their suits, you know, in that way, which is always nice.
Are you doing Edinburgh this year?
I'm not, no. I've done loads of Edinburghs. I feel like I've made my point. I've done a lot. I've done, how many solo shows? 6 or 7, I think. But I did last year Camden Fringe, and this year I'm doing Camden Fringe again. So I'm looking forward to it. Yeah.
Where and for how long?
Camden Comedy Club for a week, the 7th to the 11th, I think, of August. That's not 100% confirmed yet, but I'm pretty sure that's what I'm doing. Because last year I did 3 days and it sold pretty well. I ended up adding a couple of extra shows, so I thought I'd try and just do 5 in a row and hope that works. But it's great. I enjoy Camden, and it's a very different experience. Obviously, it's not the fringe. It's not sort of, you don't have all the other stuff that goes with it. But you're still doing an hour show in a venue, which is quite nice. And you can get an audience along if you promote it properly. So, it's fun. and you can stay at home. Not spend a fortune on a flat in Edinburgh.
Sure, sure.
Just spend a fortune on a flat in London.
Yeah, yeah. But you have to do that anyway.
How long have you been in London for? Because you're from Yorkshire originally, right?
I am from Yorkshire originally, yeah, but I've been in London since I left uni, so nearly 20 years, I guess.
Oh, did you come to uni here, or did you go?
No, I was at Cambridge and then moved straight after that, yeah. So 2001.
What were you studying at Cambridge?
English.
Was there a different plan?
And you seem to have mastered, by the way.
Thank you. I'm very happy with it.
I've
been doing it for a while. I never really had the accent. I have a joke about losing the accent for career reasons, but I never really had it. When I listen back to old recordings of shows that I did when I was a student or something, there's definitely a bit more of an accent, but I never had like a really obviously strong accent. I just had more Baths and, you know, that kind of stuff, and more short A's and stuff, which is sort of gone now. Although it comes out under stress, I've noticed sometimes. Like, I kind of, if I'm particularly stressed, I'll suddenly start speaking slightly more Yorkshire for some reason.
It's that thing of people's accents come out when they're angry.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
As well, yeah. I become a little bit more northern if I'm annoyed or really enthusiastic about something.
Yeah. Well, I think my brain still wants to say, you know, Bath or whatever, but something that doesn't quite happen now. My accent's sort of taken over it a bit, but it's still in there, definitely.
So did you start doing stand-up while at university?
Not stand-up. I started doing comedy.
Right.
I didn't really start. I started at school. I did quite a lot of sketch comedy at school and did like end of show reviews or whatever. They weren't really called that, but sort of. I wrote the pantomime at school once, I think, or a couple of times, or at least was involved in the writing of it, and sort of it was all quite improvised and put together by anyone who could, you know, be bothered to do it, right. Basically. So we had sort of end of term shows where they do music and stuff, and I think I ended up doing some sketches and some plays and things for that sort of stuff. But comedy was always what I was more interested in, and then I did a lot of sketch comedy at university, a little bit of stand-up, and I guess I probably would count my first gigs there. Like I did a couple of, I certainly hosted a few things, I guess kind of, but not really doing what you'd call comparing now, but just sort of introducing stuff.
Right.
And then I did a couple of sets, I suppose, stand-up sets, but it wasn't really, stand-up wasn't really what I loved. I enjoyed watching it, but it wasn't something I thought I wanted to do. It took probably 3 or 4 years after leaving uni. I did a couple of Edinburgh shows, sort of sketch shows. And then I think it's what happens to quite a lot of people is that stand-up, you realise, is the way that you can be in front of an audience without having anyone else tell you you're allowed to do it. Like, you know, you don't have to work with anyone. You don't have anyone to give you permission. You can just, as long as you've got the, you know, kind of get up and go to find a gig and go and do it and ring up and make sure you can get a few gigs in the diary, then you can just start. And that's what I did, I just started.
Yeah, it is out of the live performance, the sort of most solo flying, you're king of your own domain,
you can
do what...
And it's least regulated in a sense as well. Like, obviously there are hierarchies, and once you start doing it, you realise that there clearly are, and there are good clubs to play and bad clubs to play, or clubs that are easier to get into than others, whatever. But at least in the early stages, it's completely unregulated. It's just, hence the term open mic. It really is. And you learn. I didn't do a course. I know a lot of people do courses, but I felt like I sort of didn't need to, because I sort of had done stuff on stage before. It wasn't like it was literally the first time I'd ever stepped on a stage. It's different, obviously, but I felt like, okay, I get the basics of where you should stand and how you should look at an audience, all that stuff. It was just jumped into it, really. I had a couple of friends who were sort of dabbling with it a bit, and they gave me a few numbers to call, and, you know, rest is history. I just sort of kept doing it. I think that's probably the main thing you have to do as a stand-up, is just keep doing it.
It is stage time over everything else, isn't it? It's getting that 10,000 hours.
Absolutely.
It's
Although I think that's, it's always changing. I think when I started out in 2003-04, you know, I spoke to a lot of people who'd say, you know, you've got to do it for 10 years to get good. And I still think that's true. But it has slightly short-circuited recently. There are more people who, and I think partly because of the internet and whatever, you can see a lot more stand-up than you ever could before, more quickly. You can kind of get a sense of, there are so many podcasts about stand-up, there are so many courses, there's so much information that you could
don't tell our listeners.
I mean, none as good as this, I'm sure.
There are no other podcasts about stand-up.
That's true. None set in the backyard, anyway.
Yes.
But I think it means, therefore, you can sort of do all of that work a bit more easily, whereas I think at the time it was a bit more of a Wild West. Not as wild as it was, you know, when it started in the 80s, but a bit more. And then I think I noted definitely about 2 or 3 years after I started, there was a kind of sudden explosion of Live at the Apollo being on telly, courses exploding, you know, stuff on the internet. And
do you think part of the reason that there is so many more, it seems like there's so many more stand-ups, so there are more people giving a go at stand-up now as well, is because obviously, you know, money's getting tighter in the creative industries, and it is that solo art. You can just kind of get up and do it. You don't need anyone else.
Yeah.
The people are going for that, like the creatively minded are going more towards stand-up because they can just go and do it.
I think so. I think that's part of it. I think it's related to that. It's sort of the opposite in a way is also true, which is that there's money in it. And there's obviously money in it in the way that there wasn't when I started out. You know, obviously there were big stand-ups, Eddie Izzard, Lee Evans, all that, you know, loads of them, but they weren't quite as on telly all the time. There wasn't quite that sense of, no one had played the O2 Arena, you know, when I started doing stand-up as a stand-up. You know, you might have your Billy Connolly's or whatever, who are a massive household name. So there wasn't the Michael McIntyre, you know, type guys out there. And then there was a period, whenever that was, in the sort of mid-2000s, where suddenly loads of those guys, you know, appeared out of nowhere. Obviously, they've been doing it for years. The McIntyres, the Mickey Flanagans, Dara O'Brien, all those guys, you know, all those TV shows started. And I think, and therefore, stand-up became both much more visible, therefore people knew what it was, but also more attractive to people who wouldn't otherwise have done it. People, you know, the middle classes were like, oh, okay, we can do this. This is a thing that, it's not all working men's clubs and smoky, you know, rooms where you might get into a fight. You can go, it's Live at the Apollo, it's bright, it's shiny, it's mainstream. And comedy changed from being something that was a bit underground and a bit, you had to really sort of, no one really knew what a club was unless they'd been, maybe they'd heard of the Comedy Store, but that's kind of it, to boom, you know, it's like, it's on the telly, it's in your front room. And I think that meant that there's been a huge increase in people who see it as a career. Mm. Not just, I think I might be part of one of the last generations of stand-ups who didn't go into it thinking, you know, I can get on telly, basically. Like, we all hoped that was a thing, and we've all since then thought, yeah, it'd be lovely to do that, but there wasn't that. When we started out, it was like get to play the Comedy Store, get to play the Backyard, get to play the big clubs. That's the joy. That's what you're looking for. And then maybe you might spin off from that to do something else. But it wasn't like I'm going to go and sell out 10,000 seat arenas.
Yeah.
I think that has changed a lot, and I think it's part of it. You know,
it's a different goal in doing those things. You can sort of smell it off acts when the clubs are not their destination. They've got, you know.
But the clubs it's changed now, I think. I think I was talking about this with someone the other day, that I think the clubs, there is a bit of a narrative now that the clubs are all, you know, struggling. And I don't think that's true. I think it's up and down through the year, and we're at a good time of the year. January, February is usually pretty busy, and most of the gigs I've done recently have been pretty full, and it's been great. What is happening, though, is that the sort of the industry, in inverted commas, doesn't really pay attention to the clubs anymore. You know,
no, I don't think it does at all.
And therefore, you get great acts just playing the clubs, doing a great job, but they're never going to get on telly from that. They might do it from, you've got to go to Edinburgh, you've got to go online and do a funny thing, whatever, you know, a video that gets viral, and or a podcast or whatever. You know, there are lots of people who've done well from podcasting more recently. And I think that means the clubs can feel just a little bit like they're a sort of side projects now in comedy, in a way that they absolutely were. You know, in the 80s and 90s, they were where it was all happening. You know, if you wanted to see comedy, and that's partly to do with, as I say, because of the circuit's changed, now you've got dozens of acts touring, and so if you want to see someone off the telly, you don't go to your local club, you go to your local arts centre and see them in a tour. And so, and that's meant the clubs have changed what they do a little bit. You know,
we have here at the Backyard, we have loads of sort of like very trendy things coming in midweek. You know, as the guys that run the suspiciously cheap
and comedy, a musical and
the musical, and there's a nerd night, and there's and they seem to be the things that TV that sort of format comedy rather than a Saturday night just a man talking or a woman about their life in the absolute free form that is stand-up comedy, which bizarrely, despite the fact that there is no constraints about what you talk about, we do end up all seemingly talking about the same things. Which is an interesting sort of audience performer relationship of why do we all end up talking about relatively similar subject matters.
Well, I think clubs are, I think playing a club show is quite different from playing a solo show for lots of reasons. And I think a Friday, particularly a weekend gig, you know, people are coming out to forget about the week, you know, and they just want to have a good time. And there's a kind of, you know, sometimes they might be really drunk by the end of the night or by the beginning of the night, depending on where you are. and there'll be a mix of people. They won't all be the same kind of people. Comedy has generally resisted having genres. You know, it's coming in now more. But certainly in clubs, there are still basically, most clubs, it's just a comedy club.
Yeah.
It's not like,
this you is wouldn't be have a music thing. Club, would
no.
you?
No. Yeah. Exactly, and therefore you will get some nights where you're like, God, all these acts are all different genres, really, and so, but that's usually quite good, I think, because it means that an audience gets a mix of stuff, and they won't love everything. But the danger is, of course, that in this world of, you know, instant feedback and TripAdvisor and Twitter and all that, that you get, you know, people go, I didn't like that guy, I didn't like that guy, you know, and therefore,
well, somebody turning up thinking that stand-up comedy is the shiny suits, John Bishops of the world.
Yeah.
And another audience member sat next to him thinking that stand-up comedy is Stuart Lee and Doug Stanhope.
Yeah.
Never are those two people going to agree.
No, and I think in a club, what's great is that you can then have a mix sometimes, you know, and some nights you can, hopefully you'll have at least one person who, it used to be, comedy used to be a variety night, you know, like that used to be part, and you wouldn't just have comedians, you'd have a juggler and you'd have someone doing songs, you'd have all that stuff. And I think someone like Pete Graham at the King's Head still has a bit of that, you know, he still tries to book acts like that. But increasingly, I think comedy clubs have become a bit homogenous because they go, we need to try to, you know, we're advertising this as acts from the telly, so we need to try and sort of represent that on our stage. So we just want to get
that's
people.
A hide into nothing. Clubs,
so do I, yeah.
Clubs pretending that. Also, I mean, we've been very lucky, specifically on the Thursday night gigs, which I help run. I'm not involved in the Fridays and Saturdays, apart from being a hired comic like anybody else. But on the Thursday nights, when we have the sort of Russell Brands or the Noel Fieldings come down and we have a huge bump in numbers, they don't come back.
No.
And it's not like they didn't enjoy every other comedian that was on the bill that night. They came because there was a famous person.
Yeah, it's a celebrity culture thing.
Yeah, so trying to build your club on the fact that you're TV comics, I think, is...
It's always going to be a foundation of sand. And also, they cancel a lot. So I know from experience, having booked a couple of small gigs, you know, you book some acts you're really excited about having, and then a week before they cancel, or a day before they cancel, and then you're screwed.
You know? And you've got 100 people that specifically just want
and you book another act who's great but not famous, and people are annoyed, obviously.
Do you think people are going to these gigs because, so for instance, you're saying there's some like variety in there in certain sets, and I've seen a couple of nights where you'll get, you know, you're stand-up comedian come out, do some, you know, real life jokes, things about lives, and then someone will come on as a double act or super surreal, and the audience will either take to them or just not take to them at all. They just hate them. And do you think that's because people have an expectation of, they just want to know what they're getting? They don't want to see anything new.
Yeah, I think there is a danger of that. I think that's what I think clubs definitely I think some clubs can encourage that feeling of you know, and frankly, that also unfortunately applies to diversity as well. That you'll end up with, you know, just, you know, a woman walks on and the club go, and the audience goes, oh, we don't like that. And that's ridiculous now because there are so many brilliant female comics.
We had a wonderful night here put on by Avalon of some amazing comics, and it was in conjunction with Twitter, and the whole thing was streamed by Twitter.
Right, okay.
And I wasn't here. I was doing a gig at the Hippodrome in Leicester Square, but I was keeping my eye on the figures on my phone.
Yeah.
And a female comic went to the stage, and before she'd reached the mic, we lost 4,000 viewers. And that, you know, we talk about, yeah, people arguing about, you know, how the breaks that women get or don't get, or, you know, how can they fight against when the inherent sort of bigotry is out there in the greater world?
Yeah, I think that's I suppose clubs, and I use clubs in a very general way, obviously they're all different, but there is a certain sense, I think there can be a sort of conservatism about club bookings, which is reflected by the audience. The audiences, as I say, they can sometimes be a bit conservative in what they're looking for with a small c, and they just want, and even, you know, even political comedy, that when stand-up, you know, alternative comedy started, that was the thing, that was what stand-up was about politics, really. Was certainly about the politics of society, let alone, you know, not necessarily party politics, but certainly it had a political edge to it. Whereas now, you go to clubs and, because it's become mainstream, people complain if people go on about politics sometimes. Or, you know, there are some clubs where you just absolutely would be wary of mentioning anything about, you know, I've got a few jokes about Brexit, and I occasionally do. I might do them tonight, I don't know, it depends how it is. But there's a feeling of, you've got to be a bit careful with that stuff, that you don't want to kind of, you know, upset the audience, perhaps. And that's very different from how it started. I think the things have changed a bit. It has gone more mainstream. I think clubs have gone more mainstream. And that's why the people who might have gone to comedy 20 years ago, they now go to fringe shows. They go to niche shows. They go to more sort of, you know, artistic shows. Mm. And that's reflected in what's happened with the industry, too. They've gone, well, actually, the clubs are a little
It's a real shame. I mean, I think there's a real excitement in going, in playing an audience that don't know you from Adam. They've bought a ticket
to comedy.
Yes. And you have to convince them very quickly that you're funny. And then you have to continue to convince them for 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And the fact that you have to continue to means that punchlines have to be closer together, punchlines have to be bigger, there are no long, you know, you can't have, I mean, there are some people that have the stage presence to have do very long setups, and one, I'm very envious when I do see those people, because I tend to sort of, you know, shit the bed.
Not laughing for 20 seconds.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And I do watch, one, I'm envious, but two, I look at them doing a sort of, where do they get the brass balls to not be funny for this long?
Yeah.
But that comes from the more sort of art centre touring show culture. And I suppose audiences maybe have, I don't think they are as, I mean, I remember early days of sort of doing my first open spots at, like, the Camden Jonglers and the comedy store, and you literally, be funny now! I don't think they are quite as, but they're still, I think,
they're more distractible, though. I think audiences have, I think it's changed. I think it's less aggressive now. I think there's less aggression in audiences,
by their entertainment in their pocket.
Yeah, they just look at their phones, you know, and if they're not interested, instead of going like, oh God, I'm stuck watching something I'm not enjoying, they just start looking at their phones, which is sort of worse or better depending on how you feel about it. I don't know, sometimes I'd rather they were shouting, and other times I'm glad that they're not, you know,
just let me entertain the other people that aren't.
I think that's I think the one thing I've definitely learned over the years is that you just can never tell about an audience. And I think it's, we all love to sit and analyse before a show starts, you know, oh, there's a group of 20 over there and they might be tricky, and there's those two seem a bit pissed, and it's never, you know, it's very rarely the ones that you see beforehand who are the issue, if there's going to be an issue. And you can walk out, you know, I've done it several times, you know, you walk out and you see it's a whole room full of mostly, you know, blokes in their 50s, shaved heads, and you think, oh, this is going to be horrible. potentially, and then it's lovely. And then another group, in another room, you see, you know, loads of student-y types, and you think, oh, they'll be really up for slightly... No, that's horrible. You know, whatever, and you just don't know. There are certain stereotypes that there's a bit of truth to, but actually, you know, it's all about whether they're in the right frame of mind for it or not. And if they are, then you can take people anywhere. And that's what's lovely about comedy, as you say, you have to convince them. But once you do convince them, a lot of audiences are a lot more open-minded and a lot more willing to go with you to places that they might not have expected to.
Yeah.
And that's great. And that's where the clubs can still do that. And it's a shame if they lose that, you know, if they lose that kind of...
There's definitely an excitement and there's a more sort of rock and roll edge to a packed comedy club on a Friday or Saturday night.
Yeah.
That have just bought a ticket for comedy. They're not there for somebody specific. Than there is at any form of theatre-type gig.
Yeah, I think that's true. It's a different thing, though. You know, an Edinburgh show requires, these days particularly, but, you know, maybe it has done for a long time, but it requires a narrative, it requires some sense of movement. There needs to be ups and downs, there needs to be a sense of direction in the show, there needs to be some structure to it. Otherwise, it gets a bit boring. You know, the best comedian in the world, it will struggle to hold your attention for an hour unless there's something else happening as well. Yeah. But over 20 minutes, you can strip that all away. You know, it can just be full on, you know, jokes or stories or whatever it is. But it's there, and you don't have to have a beginning, middle, and end. You can just, you know.
Are your Edinburgh shows very different to your club comedy?
Not massively. I mean, I've done a couple that were very themed. I did one a couple of years. My last Edinburgh show was very themed. And was a PowerPoint show as well. There were lots of slides, there was lots of video and stuff in it, which was great. I really enjoyed that. It was a very different kind of show for me, because it fitted the subject matter, and it really worked for that story. But generally, certainly when I've done Camden shows, it's been last year and a couple of years I did one before, a bit themed, but not too constructed. Again, I think it's different. Edinburgh shows, I had this real experience last year. I went up to Edinburgh for a week. For like 3 or 4 days, just to see as many shows as I could. And I saw like 6 shows a day. I really crammed it in. And it's the first time I'd done that as a punter for years. And it really reminded me why Edinburgh shows need a story.
Right.
because after half an hour of a really good show, you are going, where's the story?
It's all very well.
You know, this is great, but I'm now...
This laughing business is all very well. But
and that's terrible, because I'm someone who sort of hates that in a way, but I understand it as a punter. And that's because it's Edinburgh, and because, like, there's 1,000 shows on, and therefore... Mm. And also, they've probably been to see 3 already. So if they walk in and you just tell jokes for half an hour... and there's no sense of it's going anywhere, after a while, the audience are thinking, oh, we could have just done this at home, you know, we could go to a comedy club.
Right.
Whereas somewhere like the Camden Fringe is a bit different, I think, where audiences have usually just come to see one show.
Right.
Maybe two.
Yeah, they've not started at 10 a.m.
Exactly. They're not comedy blind by the time, right, you know, they're not sort of worn out by the time that you get there. And so you can do a kind of tight, like last year I did sort of quite a tight hour of...
Fringe is the one for me.
I think a lot of the Fringe is like that, though. I read an interview with someone, I think it was Bobby Mayer the other day, saying he's on tour at the moment. And there was just one phrase he said in it, which I thought was really interesting, sums up what I'm saying, is that he said, you know, in Edinburgh you have to give them an emotional experience. On tour you have to play the hits.
Right.
You know, you can't just play your recent album, which is effectively doing your Edinburgh show. And I thought that's a good way of putting it. That, on tour, your audience have come out for a night out, you know, like a Friday, Saturday night club gig.
Yeah, sure.
Whereas in Edinburgh, they want to see a bit more inside you, your emotional state,
your culture, don't they?
Yeah,
I'm not sure how much that is just the audience, though, because in 2012, the festival started very badly for everybody because the London Olympics was happening.
I skipped that year for that reason.
It was terrible, mate. It was an absolute... I mean,
it was predictable.
Yeah, but in hindsight, it is.
Well,
but,
I saw it in foresight.
Well done to you. Like, the whole country seemed to be saying, oh, fuck the London Olympics, we're not interested, yeah. no one cares.
Until it started,
and then everybody went batshit crazy for
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
I mean, apparently businesses in central London suffered because people stayed away, although everybody was obsessed with it, they were gripped to their television. And there were people saying that it could be a boom year for Edinburgh for people staying away for the Olympics.
I always thought that was
unlikely. Yeah. And so I had paid quite a bit for PR and flyering, and it was getting me nothing.
Yeah.
So I was going out flyering myself, and my tagline was no story, no beginning, middle, end, no sensitive story about hugging my father.
Yeah.
And audiences did seem to be going, good. I've fucking had it. I've heard four stories about somebody in there that only getting to talk to their dad once he was ill or something that. But I do think that there's a certain amount that you have to have something like that for the critics.
Yes.
You've got to give them something to write about.
Yeah, it's definitely a press angle, Because otherwise, if you just say, my show's got loads of jokes in it, then they're like, well, how can we write an article about that? You know, with loads of... But if my
Everyone's
show is about...
jokes, mate.
Yeah, it's like a basic... That's the starting point for what's next, you know. And I think there's... I don't know. I think you can go back and forth as to how true that is, or how... I think there's an irony that the industry is now generally, and has been for a long time, quite... you know, mono-focused on Edinburgh as the place to see new people.
Yeah.
But the way they see those new people is through these Edinburgh shows, which are often quite emotional. But then what the industry then wants to do usually is put those people on panel shows, which is completely irrelevant to, you know, in a panel show, you need jokes, and you need a lot of jokes, you need to be quick, and you need to... So that's not... So it's a weird sort of... It's like, but if you go to a club... You might see five acts who'd all be brilliant on a panel show, but they'll never get on a panel show because they're not doing Edinburgh. So it's this weird sort of... And it's because they feel like, oh, well, you know, if you go to Edinburgh, then you can see what they could then produce, you know, for a sitcom. But again, it's like, well... Yeah, but it's still a different thing.
Yeah.
You're still taking a punt on that. And you end up with people, perhaps, arguably, doing, you know, live shows on the telly... that are kind of quite light on jokes because they're more used to doing the sort of art centre-y crowd, as it were.
Sure.
And it's a sort of funny, you don't get that kind of, you know, rat-a-tat-tat joke thing, which is what you would have got a few years ago from all those acts because they'd have all been club, you know, regulars.
Right.
People have sort of skipped that a bit.
Sounds like it might be the thing of the people, you know, putting people on these panel shows. Obviously, they go up to Edinburgh, they see this... They love the story they tell, and they're like, oh, this would, you know, like you said, it could make a good sitcom or a TV show one day, but they've got to test this person out, right?
Yeah.
So rather than test to see what they're like at a club, where you only find out what 50 to 100, 150 people think, you put it on television, and it's no loss to them because essentially you've always got your core comedians who hold up the audience, and one episode of that is always going to go well as long as they're there.
Yeah.
And if they fall flat on their ass, it's fine. But if they succeed and audiences take them, then that's a, oh, actually, this we could make a show with this person because they do well.
Absolutely, yeah. I suppose I would just wonder whether, and I think it's definitely true, that sometimes the skills you need for a panel show or a sort of quick fire show like that are very different from the skills that you need for a, you know, an Edinburgh show and those things.
Yeah.
But, you know, however you have to adapt.
I mean, I remember us gigging together in Norfolk in small town of Loddon.
Oh, Loddon.
Where we were playing some family that they were concert celloists. And they had bought this farm and converted...
There was an art centre in their barn.
Basically. They had a barn on their grounds.
Yeah.
And they converted it so that they could put on classical music recitals.
Mm.
Wow. And once they'd converted it, they went, well, we can't...
Just do.
And they put on, and I think it runs to this
day. Still runs, and it sells out every time, I think. It's one of the, I've done it three or four times now over the years, and it's lovely. And it's one of those gigs that's great because, you know, the whole town is there, effectively.
Yeah.
It's not a very big room. There's maybe 120 or something, but...
It's a big room to be in somebody's village.
Yeah,
to be in somebody's garden. Yeah,
exactly. And the green room is literally their living room. Their living room,
really?
Basically, and all that stuff. And there's a dog wandering through and the kids are running around and it's quite... But yeah, once you get into that room, it's a was a lovely gig. And those, yeah, but yes, you're very aware that you're in a community. Yeah. But those are some of, I don't know about you, I feel those are often my favourite gigs, are the ones where you go, you know, you're very much the outsider in their space, and you kind of, they enjoy you, you know, mocking them, and they enjoy you kind of going, bringing tales of the big city almost. There's something quite fun about that. And you can kind of be like, you can spend the first few minutes always just going, where am I? What is, you know, who are you people? And that's great fun. Yeah. It's a very different experience to playing somewhere in London where you're like, okay, no one's got, there's no sense of community here. Yeah. We're all from all over the place. And that's fine. But when you go to Loddon or you go to a little village in Kent or a little place, you know, and you turn up and you're like, yeah, this, they, everyone knows each other.
There's something beautifully British about those types of gigs as well. There's some sort of blighty wartime spirit of Janice brings the sandwiches. You know,
there's always, you know, there's always a character, Tony, look out for Tony. Tony's always the one who gets drunk before everyone else does.
Exactly.
I think that Loddon one, I remember, I don't remember if it, which gig it was there, maybe the second or third one I did, where there was a woman at the front who just was quite drunk, and but and then she got up and like tried to kiss me during the show or something. It was really, but in that way that you're like, In another gig, I might find this almost threatening, but this was, it was sort of charmingly mad, you know. She just, and they were like, oh, it's just so and so. She's always a bit like that, you know. And she's like, come here, give us a kiss, and like just in the middle of the show, you know. Right. And you have to sort of work your way around it, and then like go, just sit down now, you know, all that kind of stuff. But yeah, in a sort of big corporate comedy club, that would be really, the bouncers would be on them, and you know they'd be out. But in that situation, like, there's nothing I can do about this. I just want to sort of go with it a bit and hope that everyone else just goes, oh, calm down. You know.
And yet, that room couldn't be more different than another gig that I remember us doing together in Broadstairs.
Oh God, yeah,
that really high stage.
Oh wow!
And again, it felt like something from the past. It felt
Well, that was a Christmas. Do you remember that was a Christmas gig? It was at Christmas, and the main thing I remember about that gig, I'm pretty sure it was that one, was where, I think I only did that club twice, maybe it's a different one, but I think it was this one, where they had an X Factor singer. Do you remember that?
Oh God, yes, yeah. Yes.
It was like someone who'd been in the X Factor, but like literally had been in like the group stages, the or what, you know, the opening stages. They got through one round or something, but they'd, you know, and they were basically a local person, and had... And then when we got there, it was Christmas, and we, you know, for comedians, Christmas is kryptonite. You know, we always like try to get out of Christmas gigs, you know, in one piece if we can. And they were all getting drunk, and then they went, oh yeah, the show's actually not going to start until 9:30 or something because we've got this singer on first who's doing half an hour, and then we've got a magician or something, and then we've got the comedy, and we were all just going, oh, kill this now. You know, this is like the. It sort of remember it being all right though as a gig.
I think it was. I mean, it sounded sort of like playable. A perfect storm, and then it was perfectly fine.
Yeah.
But that, I would say that although they both of those rooms have a sort of small community feel, they could, you know, both of them had a sort of village hall nature to them. And yet, couldn't be more different.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, the Loddon one was much more relaxed, and the Broadstairs one is much
felt
more
like,
tough.
Armouring up.
Yeah.
Get the bat suit on before you're going on stage.
You weren't going to go on and tell a long story there or tell them about your childhood.
No, not at all. So do you find starting a bit, do you have a methodology to it? Do you have a different approach when you start writing for a show? Or, I mean, I find material picks you rather than you picking material, but maybe that's just the way.
Yeah, I mean, I think the one thing I wish I was a lot better at is just sitting down and writing, you know, from nothing. But I've tried that so many times over the years, and the number of genuinely useful jokes I've come up with is tiny. You know, where I've sat down and for like 2 hours gone, I'm just going to write some stuff. I end up writing something.
Yeah.
And then I look back at it the following day, and it's just nothing. It's just sort of thoughts, but there are no jokes in it. But jokes, just come to me. A lot of my stuff is quite observational, you know, weird things I've noticed. As often observational material, I often think of as you notice a thing and then you think, okay, what would happen if I just push that a little bit further into the absurd, you know, or if I did the thing that my brain is going, hey, I wonder what would happen if you push that button, or, you know, like, what would happen if that happened? And I think a lot of my stories start from me noticing a potential disaster, as it were, right. And then going, okay, yeah, what would have happened if I'd not stepped back at that moment? Oh. But also a lot of my sort of current stuff is just true story, you know, true stuff that I've worked out how to make funny. I mean, I'm in a funny position at the moment. We're in a funny point of a bit because I got mugged a couple of weeks ago, and it was pretty nasty in that they punched me, but I didn't get badly injured. I just had got a black eye and stuff. But even literally as it was happening, because I already had material about getting mugged, because I have been mugged before, but again quite badly, in the sense of ineffectively, they didn't get anything when it happened to me in the past. And I had a whole routine that I was literally working on at the time about the kind of different ways I've been, you know, someone pickpocketing me and then I got my phone back because I noticed who did it and all this kind of stuff. And literally as this event was happening, I was thinking, God, this is weird. This is sort of what I'm talking about on stage at the moment, and yet this is happening in real life.
Wow.
And then I got punched, and then I was like, oh, well, that hasn't happened before. You know, that's a new thing. And it was pretty, you know, it was a bit shaken for a couple of days. But almost immediately, I was like, there's definitely jokes. There's definitely something in this. This is a routine. And I'm in the process now of working it into a routine. And I've got, I mean, it's at least 10 minutes, if not more, of stuff that's come from it, from the situation, from the build-up to then what happened afterwards, to meeting the police, to the hospital, to the, you know, reaction of my friends, to stuff that, you know, putting it on Facebook and how people reacted to that. All those things are sort of built up, and I've still got more to talk about. I might talk about that depending on how the show is tonight. I've got like a sort of shorter version of it I might do tonight. But I'm aware there's a whole thing there.
Start with the life experience for you? Does it
almost always? Yeah.
I mean, I always think that's why comics have come back when they were abroad, whether it's just airline food or something from a different culture. It's because if you're in a routine and you're seeing your same wife stroke flatmate stroke mummy, whoever you live with, Chris, you don't see the funny of it because you're there all the time.
Yeah.
That's why when Canadian and Australian acts come over here and they are able to pick apart the English culture so well, because they're seeing it as an outsider. So I suppose that's easy, but you can see where the motivation is to
And I think people say, I think there is a lot of truth. It was funny how quickly people said that as well on Facebook. You know, I put it on Facebook and within two or three minutes, someone went, oh, get loads of stuff out of that. You know, that would be really funny. And you're like, well, I'm actually in hospital. my face is really hurting. So I don't, not think, but
not from
to
long.
Be fair, my comedian brain was already going.
Already while being punched.
While being punched, going, this is interesting. And I had a whole bit about this in my Edinburgh show 2 years ago, where, not about that, but a similar situation happened where similar as in my brain was working in a way that I felt weird, where my show 2 years ago was about the fact that I'd done an advert with Harvey Keitel, and that was sort of the point of the show. The beginning of the show. That's how it started, was me talking about that advert. And the sort of premise, the hook of the show was that people kept asking me about him, kept asking me what he was like and all that. So I assumed people must be asking him what I'm like. and so I started writing to him to find out what he thought about me. Now, you know, I didn't get any replies, I sent letters, but no one. But the show was built around me sort of getting obsessed with him as an idea and watching his films and then becoming obsessed, convinced that we were the same, you know, we had similar life stories and sort of cherry picking from his biography about things that he'd done that I'd done as well, and funny stuff like that. You know, he was in the army, I was in the Cubs, and you know, sort of making jokes about that sort of stuff, which was great fun, and it meant I could use lots of clips from his films and sort of relate them to what I was doing, and then use clips from my stuff I'd done and stuff. But actually, the sort of the premise of the show came very, very quickly, and it was before all of that in a way, because I did the advert filming on this Thursday, and on the following day, my mum had a very serious hemorrhage, brain hemorrhage, and out of nowhere, completely out of the blue. And so I got this call saying, you've got to come to the hospital, you know, she's really seriously ill. And she was in intensive care. But by the time we got there, they'd sort of done an emergency operation. She was sort of conscious, and we were talking, you know, we're allowed one at a time to come in and talk to her. And I said to her, you know, she said, you know, basically said, you know, how are you? And I said, well, you know, how are you? But mostly, yeah, I'm fine, but I've had quite a weird week. I met Harvey Keitel yesterday. And she said, who's that? And that became the kind of... And I immediately realised that was funny.
Right,
that she'd didn't... And the reason it was funny was because I didn't know whether she just didn't know who he was
or whether it was
a brain thing.
Yeah.
You know, because we'd been told that she might have memory problems and she doesn't remember 2 weeks, like those 2 weeks.
I don't think my mum would know who Harvey Keitel was.
Well, and that became the point of the show, in a way, was that the show was built around the fact that he's a weirdly... In some people really know who he is, you know. Like, a lot of comedians would see me in green rooms and be like, when that advert was on TV, go, oh my God, you know, you worked with Harvey Keitel, didn't they? Mm. And then most people, frankly, don't know who he is. And so the whole show was British people particularly. But even American, you know, he's sort of really well known, but in a specific way. You know, he's not Robert De Niro, he's not Dustin Hoffman. And so the whole show was built around the fact that people kept saying, who is that guy, or who, or what, and then that sort of built the ending of the show was the emotional ending of the show was me saying,
Harvey Keitel keeps on having people asking who you are.
Yeah, and then I told the story of my mum's illness, because it kind of really linked, it was a nice way of ending the show, because it sort of showed that we didn't, you know, actually, I didn't know what to think, and it was because it was Harvey Keitel. If it had been someone really famous, I'd have known straight away, you know.
Right.
And it sort of put, we had this weird moment, you know.
Would it be a person that you'd know that it was a head injury?
Well, Tom Cruise or someone like that. Someone so famous that everyone must know.
The host of Bargain Hunt.
Yeah, exactly. Well, for her, maybe, I don't know who that would be. Someone more of her generation. But I think it's Stephen Fry or something, you know, if I'd said that. But that was a really good example where that I knew right from the beginning of writing that show that moment was going to become, was going to be like the ending of the show, or near the ending of the show. That was going to be... But it took me months to work out how to make it funny and how to get it to fit together. And the number... I had to set up during the show enough people saying to me, who's he? Who's that?
Yeah.
What's that? Who's that? Before that punchline worked at the end, before her saying that got a laugh.
Sure.
Because I did it a few previews and they just were like too sad or shocked or, you know, and I had to sort of, and then I worked out, okay, I have to be clear that she's fine and she didn't die and she's okay and she's not, you know, so I have to set that up. And that's the process, isn't it, with those shows, that you kind of spend the whole time going back and forth through the show going, right, it's like, you know, you squeeze the orange in the ball in one place and it pops up in a different place and you think you've solved one problem, but actually another problem comes in. And that's why I think those kind of Edinburgh shows are interesting to write, but they're quite hard. They're quite hard to write because you have to write them as a whole in the end. You can build them up slowly as bits, but then in the end you have to look at it as a whole piece. You know?
Sure.
Does
that mean that you find it hard to break bits off and after the fact?
Certainly that show, yeah. That show was useless for that. Like, that's the most useless show I've done in terms of breaking stuff off afterwards, you know. Because it was a piece, and because it had a lot of, you know, there were lots of slides and lots of video and lots of stuff.
Right, okay.
You know?
Yeah.
And also, it was all about Harvey Keitel, which I could make funny in the show, but doing it in a club would have made no sense at all. I could do, like, maybe 2 minutes of it. I could have done a sort of very, very condensed version of the opening, you know, and sort of said... But even then, it wouldn't have been that interesting because the audience was like, well, why are you telling us that? You know? But part of the fun of that show for me was talking about Harvey Keitel for an hour.
Right.
When the audience... And it was, you know, it's called...
What was it called? What
called
was
Writing
the name
to
of...
Harvey Keitel. So it wasn't
was
like
called what?
Writing to Harvey Keitel. So it wasn't like that they weren't warned, you know.
Right, yeah.
I didn't spring it on them. Although a few previews I definitely did. I definitely did a few previews where you could feel people going... Is he still talking about this guy? But that's, for me, that was what was funny about it, was that the constant getting more and more obsessed with this guy, and like getting, I ended up trying to hire a lookalike of Harvey Keitel and all this stuff. All that kind of stuff just became more and more funny. It became one of those shows where it became a sort of obsession show, you know, right.
What's the show this year going to be about?
Well, it's called These People at the moment. I might change it to, that's a working title. I might change it to, you know, something like being punched in the face or something. Right. But I think These People works because I think it's
as funny as being punched in the face.
Yeah, something like that. Or, you know, what it's like being, or punchline or punch face or something. I haven't quite worked it out. But I think I might stick with These People because I think I'm going to talk about, like, keep it fairly loose, but talking about the people in my life. So the people who have, you know, done a thing in my life. So people in my family, people in my work, but also obviously it's now going to be about the people who were, you know, mugged me or tried to mug me, or and also I've got a whole long section at the moment.
Strange writing room you have.
Well, quite. I need to not keep employing them.
This costs you one wallet per day.
Yeah. And also I've got a routine about Twitter. I had a tweet that went viral last year, like really properly viral, which I've never had before.
Yeah.
And it was about Brexit, so I've got a lot of fun reactions to that that I can talk about and then sort of spin off from that and talk about.
Can you tell us what the tweet is? Or?
Yeah, I'm not sure I can remember it word for word, but I will remember it soon. But it was something like, Brexit increasingly feels to me like a 50-year-old man getting divorced because he can't wait to go on Tinder and meet loads of 20-year-olds. And that's what went viral, yeah. Because, you know, the obvious point being there are no 20-year-olds that will like him. And, you know,
if we're divorcing Europe, who are the 20-year-olds that
exactly.
We're going
to go? Yeah, exactly. And
America?
Sorry?
Iceland?
Well, quite. There aren't any. And those 20-year-olds are all fictitious, you know. But what was fun about that tweet was
sex bots.
Exactly. And it was funny how many people replied to tell me what my joke was. It was, you know.
Nice. Well, like what I just did.
Exactly. Yeah. But versions of that. But it got more and more ridiculous, you know, as it went on. And it got more and more. People said, oh, that's a great, you know, I like that analogy. And then it just got more and more attention. It got the key moment was when it got retweeted by J.K. Rowling.
Wow.
And then it went mental. It went ballistic.
I talked about this in the last podcast, but not about what I tweeted about it. I've just read a book called Why I'm No Longer Talking to White People About
That. Yes, I've read that. It's great.
It's brilliant. Yeah, absolutely great. Brilliant. Yeah. And I tweeted that...
I think everyone should read it.
And then my tweet was that everybody should read this.
Yeah.
And my first tweet was, not an easy read for a white man. Spent the first half trying to argue my point and slowly realised I was in denial, and she's right about everything.
Yeah.
And then I followed it up with going, this book is a bit like a punch in the face, but hopefully a punch in the face that results in reconstructive surgery and leaves you with a better face.
Yeah.
And I had that online for about an hour before people were starting to misinterpret it, that I had a problem with the book being a punch in the face.
So
I just deleted it and tapped out. Maybe if I'd been comedically bolder, I would have left it up there. I just was like, oh God, I've had enough of being misinterpreted.
That's what's weird. I mean, Twitter obviously does that all the time. That sort of, or people on Twitter do that all the time. They misinterpret stuff.
Well, yeah, but I it's, mean, you know, it's par for the job. But But having just read that book, I did not feel ready to defend anything about people.
Well, that's, you know, I think there are maybe three or four books I think everyone needs to read, you know, current, recent books. I think one of them is that. One of them is John Ronson's So You've Been Publicly Shamed.
That's great. All of John Ronson's.
You know, all of that stuff. But that one particularly, because I think it just, you know, if you're ever going to go on Twitter or Facebook, be aware. This is what could happen. You know, this is like, be aware that if you make a joke that people misinterpret, that could cost you your career. You know, if you're not someone who works in comedy.
I wish I'd read that before my shame of the headbutting.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Because it's a very good, blueprint of how to deal with.
Yeah.
Because I think I recovered a lot slower from that whole process. Because of how shamed I felt guilty. I felt I'd done something wrong.
Yeah.
As much as I felt it was blown up out of utter proportion.
Yeah.
my own guilt and shame and apologising for it made it a shit lot worse. They sort of trump, you can't shame the shameless.
Well, that's, we're in a weird situation now, aren't we? Yeah, yeah. Where if, you know, I think, you know, I think shame is important, but he, what he points out in that book is that, you know, proportionality is the key thing. You know, it's absolutely correct to shame someone like Trump who has done terrible things, but if they're not someone who's done terrible things, we shouldn't judge everybody by just a tweet or a Facebook. Yeah. You know, we all know that our own tweets are all random and sometimes they mean what we think and sometimes they're just a sort of stupid idea. And that doesn't mean that if you accidentally make a silly joke that gets misinterpreted, that should lead to the end of your, you know, career or certainly for a while, you know. And also that the, just reminding you that the online world is the real world now. Like,
whether you like it or not,
There's no separation anymore. You can't, the old thing of, oh, just turn it off. That doesn't exist anymore.
I did start a pseudonym on Twitter, which I thought are all the things
Wavy Dykley.
That I could, that I thought anything that I think dubious, I can do it under a character.
Yeah.
And I just ended up never tweeting from the pseudonym because if I'd been motivated enough to say something, I
say it as yourself.
Wanted to say it, you know.
Fair enough.
If I thought it was clever enough to bother typing.
Yeah. Take the credit.
Yeah, exactly. Because no one presumably
thinks they're
going to get in trouble at the point of typing.
The only thing I did with this tweet, which I'm glad I did actually, was which is maybe not what I normally do, is once I saw, and it was, I've only had a few tweets go viral at all, and this is the only one that's gone massively viral. A few have got a few hundred retweets. This has had several thousand. But when it happens, it always happens quick. I found it happens quite quickly because it's just usually like one of the few people who've got a lot of followers who follows me will retweet it, and then he's like, there's a little explosion, and you go, wow. Oh, okay. And as soon as I saw that it was getting a bit of traction, but also getting quite a lot of replies, I decided I wasn't going to interact with anybody. I was just going to let it be its own thing. Like, just go, that is, I think actually, you know, I think that tweet actually says what I wanted to say. Right. I don't think it needs any clarification. I think it's a joke. It's an analogy that I think works. I'm happy to defend it, but I'm not going to. I'm not going to spend the whole day going, actually, no, what it means is da da da. So I just left it. And I felt that was quite interesting, just dropping one stone and seeing where it rippled, because, you know, it went all around the world, all around the internet. And people started arguing with each other about it, which was lovely. You know, people going, oh, he's talking bollocks, this isn't true, because da da da. And then someone will go, no, actually, I think he's talking, you know, he's actually talking sense. And then these conversations would spiral off into weird, surreal things. And that's what I'm going to talk about in my show, is like how funny it was watching sort of from the sidelines, you know, just saying one sentence has led to, you know, people having arguments with each other all across the world. It's kind of amazing.
Cool, nice. Well, we're going to have to wrap this up because we have a show to do.
We do.
Good point. With the people of East London need to be entertained of a Friday night.
Bethnal Green.
So you are doing this show, which will probably be called These People, but if they just look in the Camden Fringe brochure.
Camden Fringe brochure, for Matt Green.
That's my name.
My website's mattgreen.org, and all my...
And your Twitter handle is?
All my social media is Matt Green Comedy. Matt Green Comedy. Facebook, Instagram, all that stuff.
On fucking brand. Well done.
Well, a while ago, I sort of like put them all together. I sort of consolidated them all into the same because it was getting annoying having slightly
different ones. Have you got different ones for Instagram?
All Chris Ellis Daisy.
Yeah.
Apart from my Instagram, actually. That's... Yes, you can, Stacey. That's where I put my positive stuff.
Lovely stuff.
Yeah, thanks.
Well, that's the thing. My Instagram's basically just nice photos.
That's
my social media of choice. My feed is pictures of my friends and scantily clad female athletes.
Yeah.
What is not to look at, nice to look at?
I mean, your Instagram is just pictures of you in the toilet. All of it.
No, that's a different feed that I
sent. Oh, is that? Sorry.
That's a private WhatsApp.
Oh, that's WhatsApp. Sorry. I had confused the two.
Thanks very much for doing this.
No worries.
Cheers, pal.
Good to see you.
Let's get into the show.
Let's do it.